Tonight on Arena, among the movies up for review, MLK, FBI and One Night in Miami. And Kate Moss continues her series of novels on the religious wars of 16th century France. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And it's to movies first this evening. And curiously enough, on this Thursday night in January, all of our films concern real people. One Night in Miami is the imagined story of a pivotal encounter in the lives of four icons of Black America. The makers of Stardust take on the task of depicting a young David Bowie as he tries to break America. And in the documentary MLK FBI, we witness the story of just how J. Edgar Hoover tried to destroy Martin Luther King through surveillance. Tara Brady, Daryl Jones have been pursuing this week's digital releases. They join me now remotely. And we'll go to the film One Night in Miami. It's streaming on Amazon Prime from tomorrow. Four leading lights of 1960s Black America: Malcolm X, Cassius Clay as he was then, Jim Brown and Sam Cooke gather in an hotel room in Florida. So, Daryl, how exactly does this work? How do we get these four characters into the one hotel room?
Well, so Cassius Clay is, as he was then, Muhammad Ali, as he is very soon to be, has just won the world heavyweight title. He's just beaten Sonny Liston and become the heavyweight champion of the world. And so Malcolm X invites him and Jim Brown, the great American football player, and Sam Cooke, the soul singer, back to his hotel room, rather Spartan hotel room in Miami, for what they think is going to be a celebration, and kind of is a celebration, but it's also an argument, a debate, a serious discussion about the future direction of Black America.
And is this a totally imagined situation? There was a play, Tara. Kemp Powers wrote the play, and indeed it's Kemp Powers who has adapted his own stage play for the screen here. Has this some basis in reality, or is that even important? Is it just a chance to throw some ideas around the room?
No, it doesn't have any basis in reality. It's a bit like, I don't know if you remember Nick Rogue's Insignificance, which was a hotel room encounter between Marilyn Monroe and Albert Einstein, which was also a stage play before it became a film. So this is a film that's very much about like contextualizing this big moment in history. And you know that these four men, like, I mean, it's not a spoiler to say we know that they're all about to embark on like very, very significant things. Mm-hmm. We know that Cassius Clay is about to convert, and we also know that the two of them are going to die in a year after, within the year of this fictional encounter. So it's a very, very significant moment, and it's very weighted in history. If anything, it's a little bit too weighted in history, because very often the characters are talking in sort of blocks of history and blocks of context, rather than talking like characters should or human beings should.
And I suppose to a certain extent, Daryl, that might belie the actual stage origins of the piece, where perhaps ideas can be spoken about on a stage in a way, if they're spoken about just on screen, it becomes cumbersome.
Well, it is a very static film, so it mostly takes place in this hotel room. And yes, it is an extremely talky film. I have to say that. But I was perfectly okay with that, I have to say, because, you know, what I was watching was a film full of people who have a lot of very important things to say, yeah. And I wanted to hear them say it.
Yeah, I suppose it's what's been talked about that's important, and we get a sense of that in this clip that we're about to listen to. Kingsley Benadire plays the character of Malcolm X, and here he is. He's confronting Sam Cooke, played by Leslie Odom, about the type of music that Sam Cooke was involved in. A bit of language in this clip, I should warn you as well.
Pissed off? Say pissed off, Brother Sam? You know what is going on around us? It should make everyone angry. Well, you know, you bourgeois Negroes, you're too happy with your scraps to really understand what is at stake here. Would you think Cash being the world champ is going to protect him from the devils that harassed him from the first day that he got here?
I'd like to see him try.
Huh? And Jimmy? Hmm? Jimmy is the best football player in the world, but he has also given money to black-owned businesses. Well, you don't think that threatens a lot of white people? You don't think the FBI is probably starting to follow him around too?
Oh, man, now you're gonna fucking jinx me.
And that is why, Brother Sam, this movement that we are in is called a struggle. Because we are fighting for our lives. And what words are we hearing from you, brother? Mr. Soul.
Darling, you send me, I know you.
Oh, he's very clear that he's not happy at all there, isn't he? That's Kingsley Benadire as Malcolm X confronting Sam Cooke, played by Leslie Odom, in a scene there from One Night in Miami. And Tara, Daryl was saying before that clip, you know, he didn't mind the fact that this is quite static and quite talky because the ideas that are being bandied around are interesting enough. Did it work at that level for you?
Yeah, well, it does to a certain extent. I think one of the issues with the kind of cramming of biography is that for all the cramming, sometimes the historical characters get lost under the constructions that are in the play and in the film. I didn't really buy the idea that Cassius Clay converted to Islam so casually and without thinking about it. I mean, we've all seen Muhammad Ali and the way he talks and how where he is of his public and how he can go on a chat show or he's at a ringside. And, you know, he knew how to work a crowd and he knew his audience and he knew the impact it was going to have. And I think the idea that he would have been so casual about such a momentous decision didn't quite ring true to me. I thought Malcolm X was better in places, though sometimes, again, he didn't quite feel like, you know, the real, like, I suppose, the autobiography of Malcolm X is such a great book and he lives and breathes on every page and they don't quite get to that level with it. But there are some really incredible moments. I thought the moment where Jim Brown visits a kind of admired good old boy played by Jeff Bridges is such a really powerful scene. And, you know, and it goes from sort of this kind of unspoken condescension to something really sinister. Yeah. Very fast, and I would have liked more moments like that.
Yeah, Jim Brown, an American football star, and as you say, he goes to visit Bo Bridges, and oh, he's all very nice. But then suddenly, when there's talk about him going into the house to help him, no, Bo Bridges' character doesn't want any of that at all. There's also a bit of humour to be had, I suppose, in the Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, in the way he behaves. It's Ellie Gorey who gets to get some of the funniest lines. I think probably it's safe enough to say in the film. Let's listen to him. This is he's just knocked out the reigning champion Sonny Liston. And he comes into the room with Sam Cooke, Malcolm X, Jim Brown, all there. And he's a pretty happy guy.
Yes, yes, Cassius Marcellus Clay is the new heavyweight champion of the world, boy.
Yes, he is.
And I don't even have a scratch on my face. Oh, my goodness.
Cash.
Why am I so pretty?
And
I'm only 22 years old. There is no way I'm supposed to be this great. Look, Alexander the Great conquered the whole world at the age of 30, and I conquered the world of boxing at 22 without sustaining so much as a scratch.
That's right.
There he goes.
You do the math.
All right. When is this party going down?
Yeah, that's a good question. What's on the agenda, Malcolm?
Well, I thought this would be a wonderful chance for us to reflect on what's happened tonight. Like our young brother said, there's no denying that greater forces were at work.
You mean no one else is coming?
Well, rest assured, my brother, you're not missing anything.
There you go. Ellie Gorey as Muhammad Ali, or Cassius Clay as he was at that point in his life. Leslie Odom Jr., Sam Cooke, Kingsley Benadire as Malcolm X, Jim Brown played by Alice Hodge in that scene from One Night in Miami. So does the balance work overall? Is it, you know, it is quite a long film. It's the guts of 2 hours, which again probably shows that theatrical origins. Does it work? Did it work overall for you, first of all, Daryl?
Oh, I was riveted all the way through. I thought the four leads were all stupendous. I mean, we heard Gori there sounding extraordinarily like Muhammad Ali and saying the kinds of things that we are used to hearing Ali say. So there are riveting performances. I was particularly impressed, I thought, by Aldis Hodge with this kind of watchful, intense performance as Jim Brown, the character I knew least about, I have to say. So yeah, I wasn't bored for a moment.
And stars then from you, Daryl?
Four.
Four. What are you saying overall, Tara?
3.5.
3.5 from you. You weren't as enamoured, is that what I'm picking up from that?
I still think it's a very significant release, and it's a great debut from Regina King, and who we know was an actor from If Beale Street Could Talk. So it's a very, very promising debut, definitely.
All right, let's move on then to film number two, and we're in the world of documentary here. Sam Pollard's feature documentary about the FBI's dogged pursuit of the civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. in what is characterised by the recently retired director of the organisation, James Comey, as, quote, the darkest part, unquote, or end quote, rather, of the agency's history. Just to explain to us the form of this movie, because it's a mixture of talking heads and archive, but we don't see any talking heads here, Tara.
Yeah, it's very well crafted together. I mean, suppose this sort of central plank is about this letter that was sent to Coretta Scott King, who was the wife of Martin Luther King. We know in 1964 she received a letter which purportedly contained a recording of her husband's infidelities with this horrible anonymous letter, which was not just like threatening for blackmail, but actually asking Martin Luther King to kill himself and suggesting that he needed to kill himself for the sake of his followers. That letter we think now was written by the FBI's Director of Domestic Intelligence Operations, William Sullivan, and it was part of the FBI's kind of larger counter-pro operation against King, and others. And I think that the thing is that we've known about this letter from, I think, the 1970s, but this film, Sam Pollard's film, actually makes it incredibly alarming and feels very urgent. And I think it's significant that James Comey says what he says about it.
Yeah.
And I also think, I mean, there are very, very good contributions from other sort of talking heads we've seen in other documentaries, like Donna Mersch and Beverly Gage, who are two very good historians who were in the Black Panther's Vanguard of the Revolution documentary a few years ago. And we also get some of King's trusted lieutenants. Yeah. Clarence Jones and Anthony Young. So there's a very, very good balance of things, plus this kind of wider history of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover's fear of the rise of a black messiah, his need to have this very, very specific image for the FBI of like clean, you know, white, straight,
yes,
black men, the kind that you saw in purpose-built FBI propaganda from the 50s and 60s, like Walk a Crooked Mile.
Yeah, well, let's listen to a clip that mentions some of the voices that you touched upon there, Tara. Beverly Gage and Donna Mersch, the two historians, and indeed in the midst of this as well, you'll hear Dr. King's lawyer and advisor Clarence Jones all talking about how the FBI were out to get Martin Luther King, and you'll hear his voice just towards the end as well.
The FBI was most alarmed about King because of his success. And they were particularly concerned that he was this powerful, charismatic figure who had the ability to mobilize people.
And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring.
When you look at the social movements from the point of view of the FBI, it looks very different. You know, J. Edgar Hoover is famous for saying that he feared the rise of a black messiah.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty! We are free at last!
After Dr. King gave his famous March on Washington speech, Wednesday, August 28, 1963, in a memo dated the 30th of August, no later than that, the second person in the FBI, it may have been Sullivan, sends a urgent memo in which he says, after the March on Washington, it's clear that Martin Luther King Jr. is the most dangerous Negro in America. And we have to use every resource at our disposal to destroy him.
So the voices there of Beverly Gidge, Donna Mersch and Clarence Jones, and in the midst as well, of course, Dr. Martin Luther King himself at one of his rallies. There's an issue here, and I think it was a problem, a very big problem for you, Daryl, in that some of this material is not due to be declassified around the documentation, the FBI documentation. It's not due to be declassified until 2027. Why is that such a problem for you?
Oh, I have to say, I found this film a very disconcerting film, a very difficult film to watch, and I've thought about it a lot, and I've come to the conclusion that I wish I hadn't seen it, in fact, because there is no doubt that the FBI's surveillance campaign was simply unethical and immoral. It was prurient, it was racist, it was wrong. Even James Comey admits that, you know? So there are serious moral and ethical issues here. Ethical issues about what we should or should not know. And in watching this film and being exposed to this material, which should never have been sought out, which should never have been found, which should, you know, are we complicit in a smear campaign, in a historical smear campaign? I thought we were.
But isn't this film pointing out just how wrong that material was, and just how wrong it was for that material to be used at the time? Is it not important for us to know that it was used and to make our own judgments on that?
I think that's a position, that's a point of view, and I understand that point of view, but I also understand the point of view of another of the FBI agents interviewed, who said that, you know, on declassification, he thought that this material should be destroyed because no good could possibly come from the declassification of this material. If something is unethically sought out, Do we not become the stooges of J. Edgar Hoover, even in being exposed to this? That was my real worry about this film.
Yeah. Did you have any anxieties or thoughts around that aspect of the film, Tara?
No, because I think that is actually what the film is asking. I think the film is asking, you know, okay, we can open these things in 2027, but should we? I think several contributors addressed that directly. And I definitely think that's director Sam Pollan's kind of larger point, is that there are huge ethical issues here, and we really need to think long and hard. And I think that the film also works very hard to make sure that around the story that it's building and the case against those tapes, there's all... He leaves King to do a lot of talking. We get a lot of archive footage of King, that way it allows him to tell his own story, and it allows the King that we knew and admired to exist in the movie. And I think the film never loses sight of that King. I mean, we get that lovely interview that he has with Merv Griffin, and we get him laughing, we get him talking through his background, and I think that's a very important facet of the film, and I think the director knows that it's a very important facet of the film.
Let's listen to another clip again about historian Beverly Gidge involved here, giving us a sense of just how long Hoover was in charge of the FBI. And when you think of events in Washington in the last week, I think there's a chilling familiarity to some of this.
To some people, J. Edgar Hoover was a great American, a hero who stood up against crime and communism. To others, he was a figure of profound evil who terrified those he disapproved of with police powers at his command. To everybody, he symbolized the FBI.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation is as close to you as your nearest telephone. It seeks to be your protector in all matters within its jurisdiction. It belongs to you.
J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the FBI for 48 years, from 1924 to 1972, and it's a really astounding span of time. He went from a period in which Washington was kind of a nothing backwater to a moment when it was really the pinnacle of American power, and he helped build a lot of that.
The communists have been, still are, and always will be a menace to freedom, to democratic ideals, to the worship of God, and to America's way of life.
There you go. Another clip there from MLK FBI, the new documentary. And Daryl, when we listen within that, we hear the fear of communism, you know, nothing new in that. But there's also, throughout this film, you get a real sense of white discomfort with black sexuality. And the film is very clear in how it depicts that.
Oh, it is. And the kind of the demonizing of black sexuality. And so, you know, that I think is part of the prurience of the surveillance campaign that's going on here. You know, this is bugs in hotel rooms. This is wiretaps, all to find out, you know, things that we don't want to know about Martin Luther King's sexual habits. And the film sort of gestures towards, but doesn't really go very far towards describing the fact that J. Edgar Hoover himself was a man with extraordinary sexual secrets of his own. So I kind of wondered why the film was, it struck me as kind of studiedly neutral on Hoover himself, in a way that I found a little shocking. You know, the film opens with an archive clip of Ronald Reagan, archive footage of Reagan, saying something like, you know, the story you are about to watch has no straightforward good or bad guys. There is no easy morality to you. And I wondered, why Reagan? And what's he actually saying here?
All right, so you are uncomfortable with this film. Can you recommend it, or do you, are you just saying you felt bad about seeing it, so you're going to tell others not to? Is that where you're
I wouldn't say that. And, you know, as I said, I think the film is aware of the ethical difficulties that it raises. But I think people should also be aware before going in of what kind of film they're about to see.
All right. So stars, how does that translate into stars for you, Daryl?
Oh, three.
Three. What are you saying overall then, Tara?
I think it's a very important film. I think it's important to remember, like, Hoover didn't act alone. And Robert Kennedy approved the taps on Martin Luther King's phones. Lyndon Johnson turned against King after King turned against the Vietnam War. And these are really important things to think about and to remember. I think it's a great documentary. I think it asks very, very important ethical questions. I'm happy to give it four.
All right. So a slight difference of opinion for sure there on MLK FBI. Let's move on then to our final film. And, you know, as I said, real people at the heart of all three films this evening. And I was very excited to see, oh, we're going to hear about David Bowie and his attempts to break America in the early 1970s. A very young David Bowie played bravely, taking on the task is Johnny Flynn. Were you excited, Tara?
Yeah, no, definitely. I was very excited. Gabriel Range, the director, he has a very long career, but he's best known for kind of documentary drama mashups like Death of a President, which was released here, gosh, about 15 years ago now. And this was a great idea, but I knew going in that there had been an issue, and that is, in fact, a huge issue in the film. Bowie's estate did not approve the film, and it did not grant the film rights to use Bowie's music. And that becomes an absence in the film that's sort of insurmountable, despite the fact that Johnny Flynn, who's so great in Beast and Emma, is really, really great here. I mean, he's a very, very good Bowie. But the film has to, in order to get around this problem with the rights, introduce this kind of silly notion that David Bowie goes to America, he meets his American tour manager, and the tour manager immediately tells him that because of some visa mishap, Bowie will be able to give interviews, but he won't be permitted to perform. And that's just one aspect of the film that all the way through you're watching the film. We were talking about One Night in Miami and not forgetting it's a play. You're all the time watching this film and thinking, well, you know, it's good that there being this, you know, imaginative, and they're trying to work around this problem, but you never forget that they're trying to work around this problem.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll come to you because I know there's a big difference of opinion here as well, Daryl. Let's listen to a little bit of Johnny Flynn as the young David Bowie, and he's looking for some promotion ideas. He's passing these on to his mildly sceptical publicist, Ron Oberman, played here by Marc Maron.
Any news on Rolling Stone?
I'm working on it.
That John Mickelson, he's like
a swippery fucker. hard to pin down, man.
Perhaps, I mean, you know best, of course, but perhaps there's a different way to talk about me when you're on the phone.
Okay.
I mean, maybe more people would want to meet me if you told them that I was a unique artist, say, who could fill the gap between Elvis and Dylan.
Hmm. Elvis and Dylan, gap. So, who do we got in there? Neil Young, James Taylor, Marvin Gaye, Leonard Cohen, the Ohio Players, the Doors, the Velvets, Creedence, Johnny Cash, Janis Joplin, Joni Mitchell, every artist on the Motown label.
I mean, a unique British artist.
Right, unique British artist. There aren't too many of those other than Led Zepp, Pink Floyd, Deep Purple, Yes, yep. Pretty Things, yep. Faces, Rolling Stones. Rolling Stones.
Good, there you go. Mark Maron as Ron Oberman, Johnny Flynn as David Bowie. You didn't like Johnny Flynn here at all, in fact, Daryl.
No, I didn't like her. I was looking forward to this film. I'd heard things about it as well. I thought he was all wrong. First of all, he looked wrong. I thought he was too hunky. Modern actors are the wrong shape for. They're too healthy to play, you know, fundamentally unhealthy 1970s rock stars who spend their lives driving up and down the M1 in a transit van and eating fish fingers and smoking Embassy Regals. You know, he looks like he has a personal trainer. So first of all, there's that, and he's not the only offender here, I have to say. But also, you know, we heard him there. David Bowie has one of the most recognisable speaking voices in the world, I'm not expecting a straightforward act of mimicry here, but it seems to me that Flynn just went for a sort of generic camp. Sometimes he sounds like Frankie Howard. Sometimes he sounds like Eddie Izzard or Boy George sometimes, or even Alan Carr. There he sounded a bit like Mick Jagger. What he didn't sound like was David Bowie.
You didn't enjoy this. Well, no, I'll come back to you to give you a final thought. Are you as down on you liked Johnny Flynn? What about some of the other performances for you, Tara?
I think there are good things in this film. I think that Johnny Flynn actually has, you know, you forget, and I think what the film is good at is capturing. This is a moment where David Bowie's career is almost over. I mean, he's suddenly a fly. It's a long way from The Man Who Sold the World, and you know, he's you know, it could be that he's done, and he's like, and you get this sense. I think Flynn is very good at capturing how vulnerable he feels, and also his terror of succumbing to the mental illness that has affected his brother. I like some of the visual things that they've used to suggest Bowie, given that they have no music. So, like, I love the shot of him that repeated shot of him in a spacesuit, which, like, both, like, kind of gestures towards space oddity and also, like, has this kind of, you know, effectively communicates feelings of isolation. I love Jenna Malone's Angie Bowie. I thought she was absolutely terrific, and I thought it was a much more sympathetically written Angie than, you know, is often given in other accounts. But yeah, I don't think there's a great sense of who Bowie is here, and I'm very disappointed that Daryl thinks that young actors should take up Embassy and Fish Finger.
Stars before I get let Daryl answer that, Tara.
Two and a half,
right. Defend Embassy and Fish Fingers as potential acting school material, Daryl. And you might also tell us what you thought of the portrayal of Mark Boland before you give us your stars.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so James Cade plays the world's ugliest Mark Bolan. Mark Bolan was a beautiful man. But this guy, he looks like, you know, Ralph Brown's Danny the drug dealer in With Nail and I. And he spouts horrible, horrible poetry. You know, and when I heard the poetry and saw this guy, I thought, oh, God, please don't make that Mark Bolan. And of course, it was Mark Bolan. Yeah. But I, you know, they were, like Tara, there were things that I liked about the film. I thought the relationship with Ron Oberman was rather sweet and rather touching. And I kept thinking, you know, why didn't they make a road movie about a fictional weird English singer and his exasperated publicist driving across America on a publicity tour? You know, it would have solved the film's problems of a stroke,
I
think.
Okay, right. And stars then from you, Daryl?
Two and a half again.
And that is Stardust, directed by Gabriel Range. Digital platforms from tomorrow. And the other two films that we were speaking about this evening, MLK, FBI, also available on digital platforms from tomorrow. And One Night in Miami, available on Amazon Prime. Kate Moss is the author of the best-selling historical fiction, including The Burning Chambers, the first in a series of books that follows the fortune of the Huguenots from 16th century France and the wars of religion to 19th century South Africa. Her latest novel, The City of Tears, takes up the story in 1572, 10 years into the ferocious wars, when it's hoped that a royal wedding between the Catholic Margaret of Valois and the Huguenot Henry of Navarre will bring peace. And delighted to have Kate Moss join us on the line now this evening. The Burning Chambers, the first in this series, a series of four, I believe, that we're going to get, Kate. The Burning Chambers, the first, had the Toulouse Massacre of 1562 at its heart. And now in the City of Tears, the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre in Paris 10 years later is very important. So these French religious wars are the source of this series of four books. What is it about those wars that really attracts you as a novelist? And in fact, is the term religious wars maybe a misnomer here?
Well, hello. Lovely to be with you, even though we're, you know, miles away. Yeah. And I really loved listening to those film reviews. That was a real treat. So the thing is, this period of time, incredible upheaval in France. And it really was this moment, the 16th century, what made France the country she is today. And in a way, what made Europe the place it is today. The Reformation, people fighting. And as you say, are they religious wars? Not really. Religious wars are never about faith. They're always about power. They're always about influence. They're always about people wanting to control other people's way of living and thinking and worshipping and all that sort of thing. But for me, because I've had a love affair with the southwest of France, Carcassonne in particular, for 30 years now, I really wanted to write about an ordinary family like any of us could be, caught up in this incredible moment of history. So I do all my research, and the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre is a key turning point in the wars of religion, where thousands of people are killed on the 24th of August, you know, in the space of a few hours. It's an ambush. The Catholics have shut the gates of Paris. They have put chains across the streets. But what I'm trying to do is say, okay, my family, Joubert family, they're there. They're caught in the middle of what will be in the history books for generations. But what they're interested in is their conundrum. Something terrible has happened, a tragedy in their family. And what do they do? Do they flee and get to safety, or do they stay and try to sort out the tragedy that's going to destroy their family? And that's what interests me, I suppose, all of us ordinary people against the backdrop of big, big history.
And I guess that was the big dilemma for many Huguenot families at that period in time. What do you do? Do you stay? Do you go? But you add a layer of difficulty into your Joubert family by having a mixed religions within the family itself, both the Catholic faith and the Huguenot faith represented within the family, which adds to the complexity of it all.
Totally right. And one of the things when I was starting off with the research was discovering, of course, we all know this, that most people want to live in harmony with their neighbours. Most people don't want to be defined by one type of thing. They just want to be themselves. And with the wars of religion, it was absolutely in France about the court. It was about a weak and feeble king, Charles. It was about his very strong mother, Catherine de' Medici, who had lost her two more beloved older sons and was now kind of a watching brief over this not so effective son. It was about the great Catholic family, the Guise family, who were vying for power. And it's about Henry, the great king he will become, Henry of Navarre, who is the leader of what they call the War Huguenots. And essentially, there is this three-way battle going on at court for control. But when you go out to other places, you go to Carcassonne, to Toulouse, to Chartres, wherever else, normal people at the beginning of the wars of religion, they don't think like that. They don't think they're a Catholic, they're my enemy, they're a Huguenot, they're my enemy, they're Jewish, they're my enemy, or whatever. They think this is my neighbor. And so it was a really interesting period of time, whereas essentially it was the top down, kind of put the whole country against itself. It was a civil war that lasted till 1594. And Henry was crowned king, Henry of Navarre, in the end, finally, and brought peace to France. So for me, I wanted there to be a Catholic and a Huguenot in the family. It's a Romeo and Juliet story. It's, you know, forbidden love. It's this one, The City of Tears, is the story of a lost child. And I really wanted to kind of say, you know, we read in crime fiction all the time, and on the, we see in the screens and the television, there's often stories about what it would mean to lose your child, and to your child to go missing, not know how we'd feel about that. But they felt the same. Their hearts were the same as ours, you know, back in the 16th century. So I, you know, it's that really, it's like all the decisions that any of us might make, and my characters might make, whilst this extraordinary collapse of the country that you love is going on. And my family, in the end, are forced to flee, make a terrible Sophie's choice, if you like. Yeah. And they're forced to flee Paris in order for them not all to be slaughtered. But then it's the shadow of the decision of that night. And little by little, of course, there's a mystery in this. It's, you know, their old enemies are following them. It's, there's a story of relics and fake relics and a reliquary in the middle of a lake, you know, all of these things, because I love all of that. You know, I'm a one for a relic myself.
and the saying going, you know, where there's a will, there's a relative. And in fact, it's a missing will here. that's a problem. But that's for the reader to find out all about those intricacies of plot. I am interested in the fact, however, how the woman who is at the very heart of the Women's Prize for Fiction would choose to have a royal wedding at the beginning of this City of Tears novel, where we have the two mothers, Catherine de' Medici and Jeanne de Navarre. They're the two women that arrange this wedding. You must have loved to have had two characters, like historical characters like that, to get your teeth into.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, I mean, I think that's one of the things I feel really strongly about. I write stories, you know, of unheard and underheard women's voices. I write stories with women as the hero, with beautiful men who love them, supporting them. So if you like, the real world, men and women in this world together, doing things together. But my lead characters are the women. They're the protagonists. Mm. And what is incredible is that quite often you find with history, and we all know this, that history is often manipulated. It is often told by the victors. It's a cliche, but it's true. But it's also often told with an agenda. And one of the agendas about women's history is often, well, yeah, but women in the past, they didn't do that, or they didn't do this, or they weren't allowed out, or they sat at home. It's not true. It's never been true. The world has always been women and men doing things together, even though power structures often have left women out. And so for me, this period, the 16th century, is so fascinating, because you often would think, when you watch the television and you read books and things about this period, the 16th century, that the only women that existed were queens or the mistresses of generals and popes. But of course, the men had been at war all over Europe for a generation. So who do we think actually were opening the bookshops, were baking the bread, were chopping the wood? Well, of course, it was the women and the boys and the older men, you know, all of this. So for me, when you come across the two mothers, the Huguenot mother and the Catholic mother, and they decide their children will marry and this will bring peace to France, because in the end, the women want peace. But then, of course, the wedding happens. It looks like it might work, even though there is a question of, did the princess really assent to get married? Is she really the lover of this of Henry of Guise? You know, all of this stuff going on. But then a few days later, there is this notorious massacre. And still, nobody knows for sure who gave the order. And not only did 3,000 people die in Paris, but they estimate maybe 70,000 people died in copycat massacres in the following days in the rest of France. So, you know, you think these two great women did their best, but in the end, you know, the mob, the mob ruled. So it's, you know, it's a fascinating story. Any historical novelist would, you know, bite their arm off in order to be able to write about it. So I had great fun writing it, even though it's pretty sad at the same time as well.
And obviously, you do, I mean, when we talk about the City of Tears, we're talking about Amsterdam when we talk about the City of Tears. So that aspect of the story is vitally important, pulling in the Low Countries and what was happening up there as well.
Yes, it absolutely. Because one of the things, again, that I find so wonderful and so satisfying, you know, not least of all in these difficult times, is that Little Holland, as it was, and then the Netherlands, as it became a world superpower. Why did that happen? This tiny country? Because they accepted in the refugees, and the French Huguenots were given refuge. It's where the word comes from, réfugié, in Amsterdam, in Rotterdam, in other parts of Holland and the Netherlands, as it was to become. And they took their skills with them, their bookbinding, their lawyers, their medicine, all of these sorts of things. And it made this little country that they made their adopted home a world superpower in the next century. And I love that too. And Amsterdam is the City of Tears because it's where my family flees and they try to learn to be different and build a new life. And of course, are caught up because the religious strife is in Holland as well, as it is in England, as it is in Germany, as it is in Spain. It's all over Europe at this moment. And Amsterdam is the one Catholic city left in the middle of a Huguenot, a Protestant, of course, as they call it in Holland. And again, learning about that, learning about the moment at which Amsterdam finally fell and became Protestant as well. Extraordinary piece of history in the middle of this very, very, very bloody century. Amsterdam passed after 40 years of Catholic rule into the hands of the Protestants, and not a single person was killed that day. Not one. That is also joyous too.
Yeah. The other aspect, I suppose, that when you mention there that refugee, that word, the word refugee, the modern word, very modern word, comes from this period in history and from the Huguenot experience. To what extent is it inevitable when you're writing then about refugee, when you're writing about the Huguenots, that in some ways you're inevitably mirroring contemporary refugee experiences?
Well, do you know, it's such a good question. But the answer is I'm not doing that at all. I really believe, and this is why I'm so excited the book's about to come out, that a book is finished by the reader. You know, I've written it and it's now ready to go out there. And once it's in readers' hands, that book is finished. You know, it's a relationship between me and readers. And the reader brings her or his own self to the novel. But, you know, I'm a storyteller. And I want to tell a ripping adventure story with thriller elements, with mystery elements, where the readers are going to be going, oh, no, what's happening next? What's happening next? And the characters have to be 100% true to the 16th century. They have to think like people in the 16th century. They have to be women and men of the 16th century. So I can't put my 21st century ideas, the things that any of us might see on the news, into the book, because they don't belong.
Right.
But what I would say is, as a historical novelist, that we know that history isn't a straight line to things getting better. People do not learn. History is a pendulum and it goes backwards and forwards. And there will be periods of great conflict and strife. And then the words will bring people together and people will find peace again. And that is the pattern. And with refugees, and the novel starts in where the books will finish, book four will finish in Franschhoek in 1862. And this is, as you said in your wonderful introduction, 300 years of Huguenot diaspora. And the inspiration came from standing in the Huguenot graveyard in the little town of Franschhoek in South Africa and discovering that seven Huguenot families, refugees from Amsterdam and Rotterdam, sailed to South Africa in 1688. And out of that, in part, came the South African wine industry. But when I stood in the, which obviously a good bit of research to know, but when I stood in the graveyard, I looked up at the mountains of Franschhoek, which surround the graveyard and the town. And I thought, do you know what? These look like the mountains of Carcassonne and the Ariège and Languedoc in Southwest France. And I suddenly understood That's how you write a refugee story. It's about hope. It's about the possibility of finding a new home and being welcomed somewhere else, because not all refugee stories have to be sad. And that is what I really wanted to do with this. Tell the story of a diaspora and say, but you carry your home with you in your heart. And the book will end in South Africa, where I first stood in the graveyard 10 years ago.
Okay, Kate, lovely to speak with you this evening. Kate Moss speaking to it about The City of Tears there, her latest book, which is published by Pan Macmillan.